and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, better thinking about thinking, coherence, complexity, and context. Hosted by Alaska Pacific University, this lecture, given by Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence, Michael Lisak, was recorded at APU's Grant Hall in Anchorage on May 2nd.
Let me welcome you all here. My name is Dale Lehman. I direct the MBA program here at APU, and I chair the Business Administration Department. I'm here to introduce tonight's speaker. I have a few people to thank first. I'd like to thank the Walter J. and Irma Lee Hickel Foundation for sponsoring the first, this is the first of a series of visiting scholars in strategic leadership and entrepreneurship. So Michael Lisak is currently executive director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence. And I just love this title, Professor of Meaning in Organizations. That's a great one, yeah. A visiting research professor at George Washington University, and he describes himself as a serial entrepreneur. He founded both a nonprofit research institute, a charity for the arts, launched an international PhD program in corporate anthropology, written half a dozen books, been a successful Wall Street banker, and a candidate for public office. In 1999, Worth magazine called him one of Wall Street's 25 smartest players, and in 2001, one of the 100 Americans who have most influenced how we think about money. Also, he's been an investment banker. In 1998, he initiated a whistleblower suit against the unethical practices of Wall Street firms. Well, you may want to hold that because he's also currently has a successful real estate practice. You have to explain how those are consistent. So, Michael Lisak, welcome.
Thank you. So the topic is, do we actually do a good job when we're thinking? And is there a better way to think about how we go about doing our thinking? So there are questions that we should be asking as we're going through all of this. So are we looking at the right things in our environment? Are we sufficiently self-aware of the things that are in our heads, of our beliefs, of where we've come from, of where we're going? Do we have the right words or the right representations to express what it is we're thinking about? And do we know the limitations? If we actually don't have the right tools, do we have enough self-awareness of the fact that we may or may not have the right tools? So there are questions that we need to be asking ourselves when we're thinking. Are we being rational? Are we being instead emotional? And if this was a cognitive science lecture, which it isn't, but if it were, the latest theory in cognitive science about our thinking is that there are two processes. That we have a rational process, and that we have an emotional, intuitive process. And the cognitive scientists would tell you that this one almost always wins.
Which one?
Emotional. And that the latest theory is, the dual process theory says that most of the time we allow our emotions and our intuition to make the decisions about what we're doing. However, right before you are ready to articulate, embody, or enact. So whenever you're actually going to turn whatever it is you're supposedly thinking about into an action or a thought, your rational system wakes up. And it says, can I tell a good story about this? And if you can tell a good story about this, and we can tell lots of stories about Becky, then if you can tell a good story about this, then the rational system lets whatever your emotions or intuition decide, go ahead. And if it can't, then supposedly, again, this is cognitive science theory, then supposedly your rational system says, wait, stop, veto. I can't tell a good story about this. And you get plunged into uncertainty while your brain is trying to figure out what to do. But again, that's the entire extent of the CogSci lecture. We move on. So again, are we being rational? Are we being emotional? And what is it we're relying on as we're thinking and making decisions? So we have to keep in mind that our knowledge and our intuition are often in conflict. So the examples I've got up are, our knowledge may say this, which is that 75% of the time we'd be better off to do A. And yet, our intuition is based on what your mother told you. And Ma said, never do A. These things could be in conflict. Now, I'm sure many of you have read the book Blink or heard of it, or similar things. Now, there's a mistake in that book, and it's a very bad mistake. And the mistake in the book is the book seems to make the point that your intuition is usually right. Well, educated, experienced intuition is usually right. Naive intuition is usually wrong. And let me give you a very simple example. If we were to go to the Iowa State Fair and ask the participants in the Iowa State Fair to look at a hog and tell you what they think it weighs, on average, the participants at the Iowa State Fair are going to get the hog's weight correct. If we did exactly the same thing by stopping 1,000 random people in Times Square in New York City, I can guarantee to you that if they did get it right, it would be sheer coincidence. And the difference is the people that attend the Iowa State Fair are used to looking at hogs and what they weigh. And most of the people that go through Times Square have absolutely no idea. This is alien to their experience. So what happens is, when you're ignorant, your intuition is ill-informed. And the book, Blink, and the things that are like it, don't make that distinction. The wisdom of crowds works if you have an educated crowd. It does not work when you have an ignorant crowd. And if it does, it's just sheer coincidence. And the media tends to just completely leave this out. But it is a very important difference. Now, the other thing that happens is that rationality and emotion often collide, and you got to then decide which thing you're going to do and how you're going to think about it. And you got to know which one is actually clear thinking. So again, I want to give you, this is not a cognitive science lesson, but the cognitive scientist will tell you that nice story about emotion does this, and then the rational thing exercises a veto. I'm going to put on a different hat, and I'm going to tell you that in my life, I've probably managed around 3,000 people. And many of them have had difficult situations. When they've had the difficult situations, my advice has usually been the same. Take what's going on and please write out very carefully the two columns, pro and con, or choice A and choice B. Write it out and reach some rational decision. Now, please take those pieces of paper, shove them in your desk, go home and do something else. Do not think about this again. When you come in the morning, if the decision you wrote down is still bothering you, please do the other thing. So my advice is that there's something going on with the intuition, the unarticulated stuff, over the longer haul that does tend to outweigh the rational things. So this question of which one is the better option, which one is clear thinking, is not at all clear. And by the way, for those who are concerned with political correctness, please notice that yes, that is a female character, and yes, I did use a stereotype, and yes, I apologize. Right? I don't want someone to think I did not notice. All right, so if we have unlimited time and unlimited resources, the reality is we can always try all the options, take the one that seems to work the best, and throw the rest of them away. But 90-something percent of the time, maybe 99% of the time, we don't have unlimited time, we don't have unlimited resources, we cannot do this. So it's nice that in theory this works, but we don't live in a world where the theory actually applies. So instead, we do what's known as triage. So the first thing we do is we try to limit what it is we're paying attention to. What is it that matters to us, or what is it that's going to matter to us at this moment? Then we limit the factors that we're going to take into account. So sure, when I agreed to come here, I maybe should have taken into account what the weather was going to be. It really wasn't one of my decisions. All right? Maybe I should have taken into account that the USS Anchorage was going to come here to be commissioned. I didn't even know about it. So it was outside of my field of attention and certainly wasn't a factor I considered. Maybe I should have. There'd be more people here tonight. But it is what it is. All right? Then the next thing that we tend to do is we predict likely outcomes. And then finally, we choose amongst our predictions and then start working backwards. And this is our normal triage method. So again, we filter almost without thought. You know, what is it that we should be doing? We narrow our context. We assert boundaries about what it is we're going to consider. We then try to create our own reality by saying, just what is it that these outcomes are that are likely to happen? And then having done that, we then choose among our predictions. I will point out, we could be completely wrong. It could be that in our narrowing down, we left out all the things that actually matter. So for all I know, and for all any of you know, maybe President Obama's on that boat today. And if that's the case, then this all was a bad decision to be sitting here. Maybe. Who knows? But we didn't know that. So Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize in economics with regard to decision theory. And this is a quote from him, and it's here for you to read. But the basic point is, we don't necessarily make good choices. Most of the time, we actually choose rather badly. We have biases, we have beliefs, we have all kinds of things that distort what seems to be a good choice. So again, let's take where we are so far. Malcolm Gladwell in Intuition said, oh, we can rely on our intuition, we can do blank, except all of the research says, if it isn't really filled with experience, if it isn't based on stuff, and if you aren't aware of the biases that you've got going on, those nice intuitive choices may really be garbage. But again, we don't tend to teach people this. We don't tend to think about it. So the big lesson is context matters, and we tend to forget that. And when we forget it, what happens? Well, the predictions that we were working backwards from could be the wrong predictions. It could be that the boundaries that we've defined the problem by are the wrong boundaries. It's actually a different problem. There's actually different things we need to be considering. It may be that we paid total attention to the wrong things. And if that's the case, if that's what's going on, then that which seems to be rational to us, that which seems to be our good thinking, instead becomes a muddled up mess. And keep in mind, most of the time, the education processes that we're either in or have been through teach you to go through this nice, logical, linear, rational chain of thought, which is great if you paid attention to the right things, you got the boundaries and constraints right, and your predictions were okay. But they don't bother telling you the if. So we do have other fields of study that are designed to deal with some of these questions. And I've got some of them listed up here. So there's science, there's philosophy, there's history, there's psychology. And then me, who does systems thinking for a living, has to say we have to add in systems thinking. So we have a goal, and the goal is, how do we make sense of things? How do we decide that we understand enough of what's going on that we can actually act, that we can hold things together? So what do? Well, we try to take into account the resources available to us, the constraints that we're operating under, the beliefs that we and the others that we have to deal with have, the history of what's been going on, whatever it is that we have access to for knowledge and information, and something that everybody's aware of, but we tend also not to talk about all that much, will. We make choices. We have many reasons for making choices. And sometimes those choices have nothing to do with any of these other things. But they may make perfect sense to us just out of will. So coherence is our goal, but, and this is a very important but, it turns out there's two different kinds of coherence. So it may be that we've got what seems to be the right way of thinking, going for consistent, this kind of coherence, which is the coherence of consistency. And what we need, because we're trying to act, is instead the coherence of experience. And they're different. And again, if you were taking the class, we're going to get into this chart at great length. For people who want to find a reference to it later, I will give you a reference to where you can get into it more. It would take us all the rest of the night to go through all of this. But the point is, the two kinds of coherence are very different. They look at the world differently. They use the same word. They both are called coherence. They both are about making sense. Their context is different. So we get the joy of trying to parse our way through things. So what I want to do for the rest of what's going on tonight, and again, what will happen in the class, is introduce you to some other perspectives for what's going on so that you have a different set of tools to be thinking about things. Now, I'm about to put on some big words, and I don't want anyone to get scared about the big words. The point of all of this is the three areas, the three perspectives that I'm going to put up there, ask different questions. And the key takeaway from tonight, and the key takeaway that'll happen in the course, is that if you go through the exercise of asking all these questions, you will think differently about things. So all I want you to do is be aware that these are the kinds of questions that maybe we should be asking. And they're not the kinds of questions that our traditional education system teaches us to ask. All right. So the first area is ontology. Nice big word. Ontology is about that which is. So the questions in ontology are, what is? What do we mean by existence, etc.? Big, heavy stuff. But the questions will all be about what is in the world we're dealing with. The second word is epistemology. Epistemology is about how do we come to know things? What is the basis of our knowledge? So these questions are going to be, once we've decided what is, how do we go about examining what we know about what is? Are we asking the right questions about those things? Have we revealed the right context? Have we revealed the right factors? And then finally, another nasty word, praxeology. This is the study of action. What is the basis of our acting? And these three things intertwine if we want to understand action, again, from the perspective of what questions should we be asking? So if I put that backwards, if you ask them together, we're asking what is? What is it that we know and how do we know it? How do we go about acting? And our goal is to have a coherent approach to action, which we get to by adding these things together. So the first part of what comes next is ontology. And ontology is going to be discussed in the terms of, there's the traditional science that you all have heard and know about, but there is another part of science. And that other part of science involves living, thinking, sentient beings. And guess what? When they teach you the rules of science, they tend to teach them based on the idea that physics is what matters. Well, we're sentient beings, and physics is concerned with unthinking, inanimate particles. And the rules just aren't the same. So we need to have a different way of thinking about what is. Then there's a model of questions to be asking about what it is we know in the epistemology. And finally, there's a different model, something called Kinevan, to ask questions about how we go about acting. So we're going to go through each of these for a little bit of time, because these are the basic tool set for what questions to be asked. All right, so let's start with ontology. So the idea here is, in the beginning, before you decide to classify things as being, as what is, we start with stuff that's very undifferentiated. You don't know what it is. You have to categorize it. You have to put it in some place. Now, some of these things are simple or are in a manner where they can be ordered. Hierarchy man works. Others of these things are complex. Interweavings matter. And I want to introduce here two words that people tend to conflate and think they mean the same thing, but they're actually quite different. So you notice I put up complex here. The word people tend to conflate with complex is complicated. Now, the root of complicated is plik. Plik means to fold. Things that are complicated are things that have foldings, which means that you can solve the complicated by unfolding them and exposing whatever plane it is, a single surface, that contains the area that you care about. Now, complex has as its root plex. Plex means to weave. So the complex are things that are interwoven. You cannot take apart the complex into single planes. If you unweave the woven, you have destroyed the whole. It goes back to that old nice junior high school or high school thing about, now that you dissected the frog, would you please put it back? You can't. So there is a qualitative difference between the complex and the complicated. So science 2 deals with things that science 1, this nice setup of simple and ordered, has trouble dealing with. So the first one of these things is a concept known as emergence. And emergence is, what happens if I change the level of analysis, the kind of graining that we're doing? Do new qualities arise? So for example, I see a number of couples out here in the audience, and I guarantee that if you were to think about yourselves as individuals, that the qualities that describe your interactions are different than the qualities describe the interactions for you as couples. Something has emerged when I put you together as a couple. Something more emerges when I consider your family. Something more emerges when I consider your neighborhood or village, etc. Well, Science 1 is not good at dealing with emergence. The next one is the fact that, again, we're sentient beings. We tend to think about things. Not only do we think about things, but we tend to anticipate things. Because we anticipate and because we think, we have a quality known as reflexive anticipation. Before we act, sometimes, not always, sometimes we think about what it is we're going to next do. Sometimes in thinking about what we next do, we don't do it, or we do something different. Particles in physics do not have the quality of reflexive anticipation. They do not have the luxury of saying, what am I about to do? Is it what I want to do? No, I want to do something different. If they did, physics would be very different. So again, this is a difference in Science 2 that is not in Science 1. The next one is that nasty one that we've already talked about a little bit. Will, volition. You make choices. Yes, there are people who want to argue that everything is preordained and that there's no choice. But if we leave those people aside, most of the time, going through our lives, we recognize we make choices. Particles in physics don't make choices. Gases that are gathered to do chemistry or those kind of things do not have molecules that make choices. So Science 1 just does not deal with these three things. So what does it mean? Well, in Science 1, we use deduction and induction. So sometimes we can deduce things directly, sometimes we do a set of probabilities, and from the probabilities we infer something, and that's induction. In the world of sentient beings that have will and emergence and reflexive anticipation, we can't do that. It doesn't work. Again, this is not something that usually gets taught. All we can do is something that's known as abduction, and it doesn't mean please kidnap people. It's the same word, but that's not what it means. So abduction is reasoning to a best explanation, but, and there's a big but here, always being willing to revise in light of new information. The always willing to revise does not tend to be part of these two. So how do we go about expressing these things? In Science One, we might use descriptions, we might use probabilistic inference. We tend to use a lot of math. We like to use labels. Those shortcuts don't work all that well in Science Two. Instead, we need narratives. We need to talk about context. We need to talk about factors. We need to talk about what matters. And when instead we try to resort to using labels and math, many times, not always, but many times, we get it wrong. And we get it wrong because in that narrowing process that I talked about at the beginning, we're leaving out the things that matter. The way I always like to refer to this is we've somehow invented homeopathic babies. Now, so you've all heard the expression that you've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. It is my belief that when you do these things with labels and math, where you needed the narratives, where you needed the context, that what you're asserting is that somehow when you threw the baby out, that the shape of the baby remained in the bathwater, and that it's okay that somehow we have this homeopathic baby still around. So the notions of what you do in Science One and Science Two are different. The notions of what is are different. So Science One is very concerned with prediction. Its entire set of techniques are, how do I go about reliably predicting something? It tends to be very retrospective looking. For the most part, it's closed to emergence. It doesn't really have a role for observers. In fact, one of the things you get told is, please get rid of the observer. Observer bias is bad. Now let's try to compare that to Science 2. In Science 2, we can't do predictions, so instead we have to be looking about preparedness. How can we be resilient? How can we be robust? How can we be prepared for the unknown that may be coming next? We tend to be thinking ahead. We do anticipatory and proactive thinking. We explicitly embrace the idea that emergence happens, that taking into account the change in coarse graining actually affects what matters. We include observers. We use a lot of narratives and we talk about a lot of what ifs. It's a different way of looking at the world.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence, Michael Lisak. His talk, entitled Better Thinking About Thinking, Coherence, Complexity, and Context, was recorded at Alaska Pacific University on May 2nd.
So, if we're going to go on from there, there's one key word on this slide, only one, lossy. Lossy means, can we lose some of the information and what matters? Science One is concerned with making things as least lossy as possible. You want reliable prediction, you want to do all those nice statistics, you want to make sure the things are reproducible and are very reliable. Science Two is far more into the, is it good enough? Can I make a heuristic? Can I do something that helps me figure out what's next? I have to leave things in reserve. Lossiness becomes part of Science Two, and it's the enemy of Science One. So now we're going to go to epistemology. So again, I'm using big words, I apologize. And this is a model for what questions to be asking. So first we said what is, and we had a distinction about lossiness. This is now, how do we ask questions about what is? So as I said, epistemology is about how we make use of our knowledge to better understand the world. And our goal is to increase our sense of coherence. So here's, we start in with the questions. So the first set of questions is another nasty word, forgive me. It's German, it comes from Husserl. The word is called Fundierung. In my work, I believe that Fundierung is probably the most important thing I study. Fundierung is those things that we take for granted that allow us to believe that there's a possibility for action. So let me give you the simplest example. You take out a pen and you write. While you are writing with the pen, you take for granted the fact that the pen has ink in it that flows to some kind of a point that will be delivered to the paper. If you didn't take all of that for granted and you stopped to examine how the pen worked, you would stop writing. And really, the only exception for that are the people that engage in fancy calligraphy, who stop and actually do change their focus to how is it that the process of writing is going on. So the second key word is a word from environmental psychology, and it's called affordances. So affordances are joint properties of an actor and the environment. And they are what possibilities are there for action. So I'm going to give you an example. You're all sitting in chairs. One of the possibilities afforded to you by that chair is for you to sit in it. It also allows you to stand on it. It also allows you to use it as a shelf. It also allows you to use it as a book rack. It allows you to use it as a coat hanger. If you were to do something that would get Don very upset, you could take the bottom of the seat off the thing and you could use it to hit somebody. So, I mean, there is an affordance of it being used as a weapon as well. All of these are affordances of the chair. They are joint properties, however, of you and the chair. The chair can't do any of those things by itself. It needs somebody to do it with them. So the next two parts of this are, again, so a big word and a little word. So the big word is pronounced synecdoche. I prefer to call it synecdoche, but that's just because I'm from New England and I can't pronounce things. But this is a part of speech that you may have learned if you actually took advanced English classes. Most of us, if we did learn it, skipped right past it. It was on a list of parts of speech, and we saw it once and answered a question and then forgot about it. But synecdoche is when we refer to wholes by parts. So we do this all the time when we use labels. We say that something is part of a category, the category has a label, and we now start referring to the thing by its category label, and we ignore all the rest of the thing. So at times we might refer to Republicans. We might refer to Democrats. We might refer to athletes. We might refer to intellectuals. Those are parts. They're labels. When we refer to them, we're not taking into account the rest of what goes on. We're counting on the part or the label. Now, the other thing that we do is that we tell stories. And we have models of how things go on. And you notice that I have here, I said, but a strict definition. The kinds of models that matter are not the, oh, this is a swimsuit model, not that definition. And no, not the toy train. But instead, something that allows us to run a scenario in our head, draw a conclusion, and act on it. And if there isn't a linkage, encoding and decoding, between the thing we run in our head and our ability to act, under this definition, it's not a model. And I want to be very careful here because we use and abuse the term models a lot. So people may say, I have a mental model of what a Republican is versus a Democrat. That is not a model. That is a synecdoche. They are different. So what happens when we are questioning how the world is organized and how it is we understand the world, the tool set here is to ask questions among these four things. What possibilities for action do I see? What am I taking for granted in seeing those possibilities for action? When I'm taking these things for granted and I see them, am I making use of labels and categories, and is there more to the picture? And am I actually drawing some kind of a model and telling myself a story based on a model? Or is there no model and I'm just using a label? If I'm just using a label, why? Again, coming back to the taking it for granted and what does that mean? There's an entire host of questions here amongst these things. And the more that we can train ourselves to ask, the different ways we will think about how we think about the world. So, again, this model's got some big words in it, and I apologize. But, and there'll be more on this later, and people can get it on the web, et cetera. But it's a set of questions, and the important thing here is, what questions do I ask among these four things? All right, now we're going to switch to the third area, which is, we've done ontology, we've asked the questions about what is. We've done epistemology, and we've said we're going to ask questions about what we know, but we still need to act. So praxeology, this other big word, is about what is the basis of our actions. And there are many different models about how we go about doing this. I'm going to put one up that I believe gives you access to the kinds of questions that help. And that, again, is the point of all this, giving you access to questions. So what you want to do is say, how do I put things together given a context so that I feel comfortable acting? And I want to cite a word here that most people, again, don't tend to be very careful with how they use it. So when you act, for the split second that you act as if you were certain. For that split second, there's one choice. So uncertainty is when you are unable to get to that willingness to act. That is different than ambiguity, where there's multiple choices and you're not quite sure what to do, or equivocation, which is there's multiple choices and you're not sure what to do. Uncertainty is about this lack of having a willingness to act. So the questions that I'm about to show you are about, how do you figure that action out? So the model is something called Kinevan, and Kinevan is a Welsh word. It means, how do we deal with the world around us? The model comes from some work that a bunch of people did at IBM and now do out on their own. And if you were into the agile programming world, I have no idea if anyone out here is a software programmer, but if you were, this is the big thing in agile programming. But I don't care about it for that. I care about it because it gives us some good questions to ask about how we go about acting. So the Kinevan model says, all right, let's start down here with the simple. In the simple part of the world, we know about cause and effect. Prediction works. And because we know about these things, what we need to do is sense what's going on, categorize, apply a label. And we can have rules of thumb or best practices that go along with those labels. Categorization and best practices work best down here. Now, instead we can get to things that are more complicated. And if you remember, complicated is things that are folded up and can be unfolded. So now they're, instead of known, they're potentially knowable. We need to go through some kind of exercise in order to figure out cause and effect. We don't just know it. We have to figure it out. And because we have to figure it out, one of two things happens. Either we've got to go through the experiments and try it, Or we can go all the way back to that picture I had up about intuition and experience. If there are experts, if there is a master versus the apprentice, it may be that there are experiences that are held by others, that are someplace out there in the community that you can rely on, and that those experiences do work and turn this potentially knowable back into the known. So now the question is, sense, analyze. Look at what's going on, conduct an analysis, and then respond. Notice here it was categorize, here it's analyze. Now we move over to the complex part of the world. In the complex part of the world, we don't know except after the fact. This is why we tell stories. This is why we tell narratives. In this part of the world, we can't really predict. So this goes along with the science two issues. In this part of the world, we're going to probe. We're going to look at the results of our probes and sense what it is it tells us. And then we're going to try to make sense out of it and respond. So we're going to be very much engaged in telling stories and looking at the stories that we have access to. And then we get to the stuff that's a real mess. And the stuff that's a real mess, which we might call the chaotic or the incoherent, as best as we try, we can't really figure out cause and effect. It doesn't repeat. We're not sure what's going on. The patterns aren't really there. Sometimes there's a pattern. Sometimes there isn't. Oh, my God, what do we do? In this part of the world, all you can do is act and then see what happens. These are all very different responses to the world. It's very important to know what part of the world you're in. So if you go through the ontology and epistemology questions, you can get a better sense of where in the world I am to have a better basis for acting. So again, in the known part of the world, things are repeatable, you can use rules. Up here, they're repeatable and you can focus on the experience of others and experts. Here, you're telling stories and trying to figure out what's what. And now down here, you know, you got to act first. You got to have some basis for action that's completely different than anything else, because you're just going to go. So we've got four different realms and different sets of questions to ask about them. And now I've gone through the three areas of what it is I want you to focus on as these are the sources of questions. When we go to try to put it together, we need to remember our objective is thinking and acting. We're not just sitting here to think for the sake of thinking, and hopefully we're not acting without thinking, though we do that plenty of times too. So as the slide points out, nothing is perfect, life is messy, relationships are complex, outcomes are uncertain, people are irrational, or as the t-shirt says, ordinary life is complex stuff. We live in a complex world. A lot of the media will instead tell you that we can deal with this by trying to make things simple. Well, simple is fine in the simple part of the world. Simple is not fine in the complex part of the world. If I need to tell a complex story about what happened to my family and somebody was in a car crash and somebody got a divorce, et cetera, trying to capture that in 140 characters of a Twitter message is stupid. Trying to label it as, oh, that was story number 127, yes. If we've all been through the experiences with each other zillions of times, then yes. We could label it as story number 127. But to a stranger, that doesn't mean anything. The other thing that the media does is they say, well, the way you react to the complex is with random. That doesn't work. If you're really, really, really lucky, it might work. But most of the time, that isn't how you're going to get there. And you know, we've got the illustration of the Rubik's Cube. And if anyone's actually solved a Rubik's Cube by picking it up and merely spinning without bothering to look, I'm sure we all like to meet you. It just doesn't work that way. So we don't tend to teach, though, that we live in a complex world. Instead, we teach you to get rid of it. So what is it that we teach? We teach the scientific method, which is all about prediction and getting to reliable prediction. We teach the idea that when you can't deal with emergence and volition and the possibilities of change, what do? You merely assert that lovely phrase that we all learn in economics, ceteris paribus, all other things remaining equal. We don't live in a ceteris paribus world, but we somehow think it's okay to assert that in part of what we teach. We go through a lot of inductive reasoning and probability inferences without bothering to mention that context matters and that what really is going on is abductive. So what do we teach? We teach that rationality outweighs emotion, that it's okay to use a label as if it was a model, and that we don't need to worry about multiple perspectives. Why do you need multiple perspectives? You know, it's good enough to just do the one thing. So it's going around the complexity. It's not dealing with it. It's not adapting it. It's just avoiding it. That's not good thinking. So we need to figure out how to deal with it, and we could go through all this stuff. It doesn't matter. The point is, deal with it, not avoid it, because dealing with it is what matters. So what's our goal? Our goal is to make things as simple as they can be, but not too simple, and not simpler than they should be, and to recognize that we live in a complex world and that some of it we can get rid of and some of it we can't, and deal with what we can't. That we've got to look at the things that matter and recognize that context matters and that often our attention is directed to the wrong things. And that it changes if we stop to think about the things that we're not paying attention to. When we use a metaphor, we tend to focus on the parts that are the same. This is like that. Well, no. This is like that in a particular manner with regard to some particular aspect. And this is very different than that in all these other things. We tend to focus on that which is the same and ignore that which is different. And it may be that that which is different is more important. But we often don't stop to ask. So history matters. I guess I'll read you the Dewey quote. No matter how ardently the artist may desire it, he cannot divest himself in his new perception of meanings funded from his past intercourse with his surroundings, nor can he free himself from the influence they exert upon the substance and manner of his present being. If he could and did, there would be nothing left in way of an object for him to see. We are products of the history that we've been through. How we frame things matters. I mean, this is a quote from Stephen Jay Gould, but again, I come back to Mr. Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in economics for this. How you frame makes a huge difference. And a lot of us frame really badly. So, how do we go about changing some of this? How do we go about thinking about how we think? And what I'm hoping is that what I've presented to you is a roadmap for how to move ahead. So what are the requirements? The requirements are that we think about all these things. What context are we in? What are the ontology questions, the epistemology questions, the basis for action questions, the actions themselves, with a goal trying to make sense of things and be coherent? And not just assume that, okay, I can assert coherence by the assertion of a label and be done. So we can start with current methods. We can explore what's going on. The exploration is part of the epistemology and the ontology. We can try to figure out what context we're in. Again, ontology questions here. We can figure out what the basis of our actions are. And if we do all of this together as a set of questions, we have a roadmap for better thinking. So this becomes the roadmap. If you're taking the course, this is what we're going to be doing over the next 3 days and then 6 weeks with some examples and trying to expand this out. But again, the important takeaway is you can ask questions in these three areas, and if you do, they will change the way you think about thinking itself. So I'm going to leave you with this. Knowledge is not a matter of getting reality right, but rather a matter of acquiring habits of action for coping with reality. And the goal of all this was to try to give you some other tools, or at least thinking about some other tools for how to cope. And with that, I'm going to say thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence, Michael Isak. Alaska Pacific University hosted the visiting scholar at Grant Hall in Anchorage on May 2nd. Following his talk entitled Better Thinking About Thinking, Coherence, Complexity, and Context, Mr. Lysak responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, do you see these theories relevant to the common man, or are they reserved for the intellectual elite?
This is usable if you take away questions and examples. Now, the language is horrible for the common man. If people have suggestions, I would love to hear them, because quite frankly, those huge words and the stuff from German, etc., turns people off immediately. I don't have any other good words at the moment, and I'd love to hear some. But yes, it is not that hard to apply. It just requires stopping to think about it. So let me give you a simple example that'll prove the point. So the simple example is we have lots of debates in this country that are very emotionally charged. People are very upset about things like abortion and gay rights and gun control and what to do with the economy, and they get very upset. Applying the labels to the other side of the equation of you are evil does not help address the problem. Many of us resort to that. It may express the emotional frustration you're feeling with the other side, but it isn't going to get you anywhere with the problem. You need some other tools so that you can stop merely telling the other side that they're evil. It doesn't help anything for the President of the United States to say, the Republicans have to get their act together. Lovely. That doesn't mean anything. So there are ways of applying things, but the question is, can we give people other questions to ask so they might find some way of engaging? The entrepreneur who is dead set in the belief, and I've been in this role, that I have invented the next great thing and I'm going to pour all the money in and I'm going to keep doing it, and I raise money from other people because they share in my belief, and I've got that mindset. Well, the problem with that mindset is oftentimes I can't see the roadblocks that are coming up, and I easily can spend my way to bankruptcy in my pure belief that it's going to work. And if you can introduce some other ideas along the way, you might be able to forestall that. But it not if they're just the blinders are on and it's going to work.
The next question from the audience was, do you believe that the thinking of Science 1 can explain the thinking behind Science 2?
Yes, well, you've asserted a belief that isn't there. Okay. Science 1 and Science 2 are equals. Neither is better than the other. They operate in different parts of the world. So it is not the case that Science 2 is more advanced. Science 2 is about the part of the world where there are sentient beings. Science 1 is about the part of the world where there aren't. And usually when we explain things, unless we are telling stories, we are explaining things by using labels and categories and models. And those are not sentient things. So yes, unless I'm engaged in telling a story where I put in people or animals, I am stuck using the language of Science One to talk about this, because that's the language we all learned. And yes, if I were in a different place and we had a lot more time, I could probably get to the same points by telling you lots of stories and lots of narratives and have you infer all the stuff I just said. And that would be Science 2. Science 2 is not particularly efficient. Science 1 is geared for efficiency. Science 2 is much more resilient than Science 1. Science 1 is much more efficient than Science 2.
Finally, an audience member asked, what do you think about people's reliance on statistical figures in seeking simple answers to complex questions?
All right, so now I'm going to put on my MBA professor hat, and I'm going to say, okay, we teach people IRRs, internal rates of returns, and how to calculate net present values, et cetera. And one of the things that I always tell my students is, if a decision boils down to a particular rate of return or a little bit of a numerical factor in a net present value, you are not making the decision based on the right things. Something else is more important. If those numbers are wildly divergent between two things, the numbers give you a clue that there's something different going on, and maybe that's enough. But if the numbers are very close, choosing them on the basis of this one is a little bit bigger than that one is probably a very poor basis for making the decision. And that what you need to do is probe behind that. So again, I was lucky. When I was taught accounting, I was taught that the accounting statement was a very fuzzy Polaroid snapshot, and that your goal was to use the snapshot to ask questions. And the way I hear that most people are taught it nowadays is they're still taught that it's a fuzzy snapshot, but that your goal is to try to figure out how to bring it into focus. It's not the numbers. It's the story that the numbers are trying to tell, and the questions that get evoked by the numbers that allow you to tell a narrative, and it's the narrative that matters, not the numbers. But that's a very hard thing in a world where people want numbers, they want short answers, they want snippets, and, you know, we've got corporate environments where the boss says, don't give me more than a page. Well, that's great. If you live in a simple environment, I can give you lots of memos that are not more than a page, and you'll do fine. And if you're going to tell me that the President of the United States can decide whether or not we should go to war with Syria on the basis of a one-page memo, I'm going to politely suggest you're crazy.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Executive Director of the Institute for the Study of Coherence and Emergence, Michael Lisak. He responded to audience questions following his talk entitled Better Thinking About Thinking, Coherence, Complexity, and Context, hosted by Alaska Pacific University at Grant Hall in Anchorage on May 2nd, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.